Welcome. This is Matthew Bronson, and this is the Matthew Bronson Show on KUPR 99.9 in the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico. Today on the show, we're going to be speaking with Reverend Drew Henry of the Las Placitas Presbyterian Church about his sabbatical last year, as well as whatever else we can come up with. So let's get on with the show. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Matthew. Good to see
you. Or I should say, welcome back. I was going through my archives. It was June of 2016 was the last time we spoke, and it seems like yesterday.
Wasn't too long ago.
No. For those who are not familiar with Presbyterian churches or people who go on sabbaticals, why don't we start with that?
Sure.
Is it different in the Presbyterian congregation or...
I don't know if different in the Presbyterian congregation. Pastoral sabbaticals are a relatively newer reality for clergy people. It hasn't, a lot of the folks who've been doing church for a long time will say to me, well, I wish I'd had a sabbatical. I'm like, well, whose fault is that? Not mine. but in the Presbytery of Santa Fe, which we are a member of, it's required that congregations provide their their pastor with a sabbatical in their seventh year of service. The rhythm is follows the rhythm of creation, that on the seventh day God rested, and so if God can take a break, so can we. And it's a time for renewal. It's not different than academic sabbaticals that may have a product type of focus where you're writing a book or coming out with an article. The pastoral sabbatical is really designed around what makes your heart sing, and take it as a season, as a time to really focus on that.
And is there a set predetermined amount of time that you're supposed to have?
Generally it is 3 months. We apply.
See, I only took 1 day,
but that was in 1 week. So this is 7 years. So usually it's 3 months after 7 years of service. We applied. Right. There's a really amazing program that's part of the Lilly Endowment that is actually administered through Christian Theological Seminary, but provides sabbatical grants for congregations and their pastors. It's an involved process to apply, but we applied and thankfully received one of those grants. And it literally is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the pastor. You can only get one of those once. And when we received the grant, several of the pastors that I got information from who had gotten those grants said, if I'd known I could have asked for an additional month, I would have, because the opportunity to really explore this with that type of support is incredible. And the team of people from the congregation who were working with me to write that grant said, we'll ask the session, which is the governing body of the church, we'll ask the session for a fourth month. So I actually had 4 months last summer.
That's nice.
That's great.
As part of the application process, do you need to say, this is what I'm going to do?
Exactly. You have to write out a program. So we began, I was on a pastoral discernment event retreat that is put on by our Presbyterian Church's Board of Pensions. I was at a conference center in North Carolina at Lake Logan, and that was back in 2015, I believe. And when I was there, part of that surprise to me, part of that discernment process, I gained clarity around the fact that I really wanted to learn to play this fiddle that I had that had come into my hands back in the early 2000s when I was living and serving a church in Birmingham, Alabama. And my paternal grandfather had died when I was 2. So I never really knew the man. And when my grandmother passed away and they were cleaning out her house, they found a fiddle that had belonged to my grandfather that was in the tucked away in the top of a closet. It's not an uncommon story for families.
Right.
And any family that finds a fiddle like that thinks they have a Stradivarius in their hands. And that's rarely, if ever, true.
Sure. It's Lotto.
Yeah. And so finally I convinced my cousins to let me take the fiddle. I was the only person in my family that played any strings. I had played guitar as a teenager and a young adult. And so I said, let me take it and go get it fixed up. And I promise you, if it is a really valuable antique instrument, I won't abscond to Eastern Europe and disappear from our lives. So I took it, and the folks at this shop in Birmingham, Alabama said, yeah, this is an old German fiddle, probably from the Sears and Roebuck catalog. And I was able to find a cousin who remembered my grandfather, a cousin of my grandfather's, who remembered my grandfather playing the instrument as a young adult. And my dad had one sister And she and I kind of worked out the timeline of it. So in the late 1920s, probably, he played that instrument in the community of Pleasant Hill, Alabama, which is where he was raised. And so, and it had been forgotten for a generation in a closet. And so I started learning to play it in the early 2000s, playing the fiddle or a violin is very different than a guitar, not having any frets, and it's a much different type of instrument to play. And I had two young children at the time and a wife and a residency program, and it became not fun anymore.
Right.
And so I said, well, I'm going to put it away, but I'm not going to leave it forgotten for a generation. And I said, when the time is right, I'll pull it back out. And so on this retreat, I decided the time was right. It became clear. And so I started working on it.
But you hadn't played it?
I had not played it really in earnest at all. I'd started taking a few lessons, but I'd really not learned to play it. So I started from ground zero in 2015 and found a fiddle teacher in Albuquerque.
Did you have use music books? Or I mean, how did you transition from guitar to violin? I mean, did you even know the strings?
Or? No, it was a whole, I had to start from nothing. And so the fiddle teacher I found is a fellow named Gary Papenhagen, who has since passed. He died right before my sabbatical. We'd become friends. It was a hard loss. But he was a Celtic fiddler and very involved in Celtic music and contra dance music here in New Mexico and Albuquerque and Santa Fe, and was a great teacher for me. And we started working together. And I took weekly lessons with him for a couple of years prior to the sabbatical and just working through tunes.
Was there a reason that you wanted to play fiddle versus violin or more traditional music? Or?
Yes, because one, it's just more of my heart music than I appreciate violin music, but the fiddle music. I come from Alabama originally and come from a Presbyterian family, which is comes out of the Church of Scotland. Right. And the music of the Southeast has its roots in Scotland and then made its way across to Ireland and Northern Ireland and Ulster. And then a lot of those folks who we call Scotch-Irish came across the Atlantic and landed in Philadelphia. And with them, they brought their Presbyterian faith and their fiddle music. A fiddle is a transportable instrument. It's hard to carry a piano on the boat.
True.
You can carry fiddles.
a flute is probably easier.
Yeah. So, well, and tin whistles, you know, are very much a part of Celtic music. And so a lot of the music that we call old time and bluegrass that's in the Southeast of the United States has its roots in Irish and Scottish music. And there's been incredible work done around that whole journey and migration of music. There's in fact, a book called Wayfaring Stranger that became one of the textbooks of my sabbatical that a friend of mine who's a pastor in North Carolina, when he heard about my sabbatical, told me, he said, have you read this book, Wayfaring Stranger? And it was written, co-authored by Doug Orr, who was the president of Warren Wilson College in Swannanoa, North Carolina, and started the Swannanoa Gathering, and a well-known name to many, Fiona Ritchie, who is the creative mind behind the Thistle and Shamrock program, a long-running NPR program on Celtic music, Thistle from Scotland and Shamrock from Ireland, sharing Celtic music. And Doug and Fiona knew each other in Charlotte, North Carolina, decades ago and have been friends. And the book, Wayfaring Stranger, tells the migration story of music from Scotland and Ireland over and down the wagon trail into the Appalachia. So I learned a lot from their book. And Dolly Parton wrote the foreword for that book.
Oh, nice.
And just an appreciation for the scholarly work they've done. So.
And when, not to get into a theological discussion, but when I think of Ireland and that part of the world, I think of Catholic.
Right.
Not Presbyterian.
Well, there were strong, obviously the Presbyterian Church comes out of the Church of Scotland.
Right.
And obviously the whole Catholic Protestant history in Scotland is deep and with strife also.
Volatile.
Volatile. And in Ireland also. I mean, you think about the Protestant and Catholic reality in Ireland and Northern Ireland and all the wars that brought out, you know, through that. But the Scots... and a lot of this is connected to that. I mean, a lot of the Scots left were forced out of Scotland, out of the Highlands when the Highlands were cleaned. And then they went to Ulster, and then, you know, these are migratory people. So Wayfaring Stranger is there's a couple of tunes that are really important in that. The Wayfaring Stranger is this story of migration into Appalachia, and a lot of these tunes that are still around have Celtic roots, right. And you can hear that.
Well, and in that part of the world, religion was very divisive. But you know,
people, where is it not?
Well, that's true. But I guess I think of it more active there because it's a smaller geographic area.
Right. And we know that history, but...
But was the music common between all of the varying religions?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. It's a wonderful question. Fiona Ritchie would be the person to talk to about that. I got to meet Fiona. I was in...
And for people who are not familiar with her...
Fiona Ritchie is a Scottish woman who returned to Scotland and leads the Thistle and Shamrock program on NPR. It's a Celtic music program that's been going on for decades. And Doug Orr was the president of Warren Wilson College, and my wife Tamara Hudson was there at Warren Wilson, and he and my dad were actually classmates at Davidson College in North Carolina. And as part of this sabbatical, I'd had this vision, really a vision to commit to learning to play this instrument that my grandfather had played when I was at this retreat at Lake Logan in North Carolina. So I decided as part of the sabbatical, I would end my sabbatical going back to that same cabin after immersing myself in the music of the fiddle. And so I went back and I reached out to Doug Orr. I told him what I was up to. He said, I'd love to get together. So we got together and had coffee in Black Mountain, North Carolina at the coffee shop there. And Doug said, well, this Thursday, actually, Fiona is going to be here, and we're going to be in Greensboro, North Carolina, Doug's hometown, and we're going to be presenting The Wayfaring Stranger. He said, I'd love you to meet Fiona. So I didn't have it on my plans to do so, to be in Greensboro that Thursday night, but that's the gift of the sabbatical. Sure. I said, sure, I can do that. So
freedom.
I went and actually picked up my friend who had told me about this book, The Wayfaring Stranger, and I said, Stuart, let's go to Greensboro and go hear Doug Orr and Fiona Ritchie. And so I got to meet her. It was an incredible treat. This is the Wayfaring Stranger tune. You've probably heard it. Let's see.
I feel like I'm in Scotland.
I love those old Celtic tunes. And so that tune would have made its way across the Atlantic, and Doug and Fiona adopted that tune's name to title their book to tell the story of the migration of the music. Right. And I got really interested in the sabbatical. The sabbatical is a wandering, so excuse me for wandering, but this when I talked to the church, I told them, I said, I really want to... spend time exploring the fiddle music, and came around to following the fiddle, which is a term that Alastair Fraser, who's a famous Scottish fiddler who lives in Northern California now and does some amazing music. I'll talk about him in a little bit. But Alastair talks about if you follow the fiddle, the amazing places it'll take you. And he inspired me when I was working on the sabbatical. So I ended up taking that as my theme and said, I want to follow the fiddle. And the folks from the church said, great, we're all about you doing that. That sounds wonderful. They said, not fiddle music doesn't speak to everybody. And so we need a wider theme for the congregation.
Is that because there's a certain amount of music snobbery, or that it's, you know, it's not Itzhak Perlman?
Right, right. Yeah, there are people who, and you know what? There's people who like green chili and people who like red chili. Right. And there's people who
like neither.
Like chamber music and people who like fiddle music. And that's okay. There are different styles of music. I personally, you'd asked me earlier, why the fiddle and not the violin? I just, that type of folk tradition just really speaks to me. The fiddle music is music that's often played. One of the differences, people ask me all the time, so what's the difference? I'm not an expert in that, right. But fiddle music is often music that's played by ear, that's passed down in an oral tradition. It is often, it has been written down over time and recorded so that it gets preserved and so that it can continue to be passed along. But I've changed, most of my focus now is all music played by ear. I can read music. I learned to read music playing the fiddle. I didn't grow up reading music. And I wanted to learn to read, but I really focused and shifted to doing more of the oral tradition. So a lot of fiddle tunes are passed down with two fiddlers sitting down and one person just...
And then someone transcribes it 100 years later?
Right. A lot of it's been transcribed and recorded, but it, you know, and they change. And so you find these tunes that were in Scotland, and then you hear a permutation of it in Ireland, and then it makes its way into the Appalachia, and it has its own rhythm and the driving rhythm of Appalachia that's got a lot of percussion in it and a lot of beat, which the early Scottish fiddling had a lot of that. And you see that in Canada in the fiddlers that have deep Scottish tradition. That actually the Scots now go to those parts of Canada to relearn music that migrated across. Yeah. So there's this rich tradition. There's a Irish band called Altan that's done some really amazing work of studying that that loop of music that came across the Atlantic over to North America, and then how the North American music made its way back across to the British Isles and influenced the music there. So there's, it's a living tradition. It's organic. And it's been moving across the Atlantic back and forth. Before I went on sabbatical was that the time, the days in a month that I have to spend hours on my instrument are few and far between. And for my goal for the sabbatical was the opposite, that the days that I didn't spend hours on my instrument were few and far between. And I did achieve that. I was inspired by the Wayfaring Stranger book and wanted to go back to Alabama with the goal of learning some of the tunes that my grandfather might have played on his fiddle. I had no way of knowing exactly what he would have played. Again, he died when I was 2 years old.
But no diary or...
There was no. And no in fact, many people in the family didn't even know he had played. And what I learned through this experience was it was not uncommon that in those days, if you wanted music in the house, you had to play it.
Right.
I mean, radio had just gotten started, and people played music, and we've lost that largely.
Well, there was no internet, there was no TV. What are you going to do? Parlor games and
so,
music.
And people played music. And so, and then oftentimes people started a family and a job, and they quit playing music. And then if they were lucky enough to live into what we would call retirement age now, but to live into an old enough age where those demands weren't as large, which my grandfather didn't live that long, they might pick the fiddle up later. But a lot of Southern fiddlers, you hear that story that they played as a young person and then dropped it for decades. And then when their kids were all grown and they weren't working every day, they may start picking it back up. And so I found this cousin of his who said, oh yeah, I remember him. At that time I was younger than I am now. And she said, yeah, I remember him playing it when he was probably about your age. He played as a young man. And so that was... Then he had a family and a business and never got, and then he died before he had time to get back to it. So, but I wanted to go back to Alabama and explore what are some of the tunes that he might have played. And so I was able to contact a couple who lives in Birmingham, Alabama, who I did not know previously, but she literally wrote the book on old time Alabama fiddling. It's called With a Fiddle and a Well Rosin Bow. And did all this research. She's a guitar player. Her husband is a fiddler. And they have done all this work on old-time music in Alabama. And so Joyce and Jim Cawthon are their names. And so I reached out to them, cold called them, and told them who I was and the project I was working on. And that I'd love to try to learn some of the tunes that my grandfather might have played on his fiddle. And they said, we can help you do that. And so I went.
That's very generous.
It was incredible. And so I went to Birmingham and played with Joyce and Jim in their home over the course of a week. And we spent a lot of time talking about music and old time music in Alabama. They do old time primarily. And it was interesting. They did two things in this book that Joyce authored. One was, at that time, a lot of the old time Alabama fiddlers were still living. Many of them have since died. And so they did oral history interviews with these fiddlers and also recorded them playing tunes. There's a CD that goes along with it. I have both the book and the CD. And then Joyce said she traveled with her family all over Alabama to small public libraries and went through the archives and found newspaper clippings that talked about fiddle competitions. It was a big part of U.S. culture in the early 1900s, these fiddle competitions. And there were a lot of them in Alabama. And
that was all for the love of the music. It wasn't for a big money prize.
$20, $10. I mean, and that still, that was money at that time, but it wasn't like big prizes. No, it was
not with American Idol.
And nothing on TV. The people who competed in fiddle competition were some of the early artists on radio. They were invited to come and play on the radio stations.
Probably the Grand Ole Opry and
would have come out of that same type of tradition,
right?
And so these newspaper clippings had real clear mention. They would say, you know, Matthew Bronson and Drew Henry competed along with these other people at the, you know, schoolhouse in Lamar County, Alabama on February 2nd, 1929. They played these tunes and Matthew beat them all. He was the best fiddler in town that night. And so they went.
I see a great partnership here.
Yeah. And so they went and discovered and compiled, really, all of these newspaper articles. And out of that, they said, you know, we can pretty much pinpoint, and through the oral history work, tunes that were common across different parts of the state. And I told people, I said, this is more about alignment than accuracy in terms of finding the tunes that my grandfather might have played. I have no way of knowing what tunes he would have played. But there's a tune that I'll play for you that is called Murillo's Lesson. It is a Sacred Harp tune. The Sacred Harp music was shape note singing that came into this country in the 1800s. And it was usually without instrumental accompaniment. And it's interesting that this tune actually made it onto the fiddle. And what Joyce and Jim said is they traveled around the state and met with different fiddlers and did all this archival research, is that Murillo's Lesson was one of those tunes that they found all over the place. There were tunes that might be in a particular region that maybe one fiddler really specialized in this tune and that were very local. And then there were tunes that were widespread. And that Murillo's Lesson is one of those tunes that was really widespread. It's a march, again, a Sacred Harp tune. And it's an interesting tune. But they said, you know, we can't know. But the likelihood, if your grandfather played his fiddle in the 1920s, Pleasant Hill is in Dallas County, Alabama, in the Black Belt in West Central Alabama. And they said, likely that if he was playing the fiddle, this might have been one of the tunes that he played. So this is Murillo's Lesson. And Joyce, and thanks to Joyce and Jim for teaching it to me.
Lovely. So these were passed down orally.
Orally.
And when they were teaching them to you, is it just like a mimicking?
Yep. Just feeding you notes. I was much slower. One of my goals of the sabbatical was to get better at learning tunes orally. And so after my original fiddle teacher, Gary Papenhagen, died in November, before I was to start my sabbatical in May, I scrambled to find another teacher, and Gretchen Van Houten is an amazing fiddler who lives in Bosque Farm, south of Albuquerque, and she teaches in Albuquerque one day a week. She won the fiddling competition in Winfield, Kansas years back, and she is a true fiddler and very much about teaching in the oral tradition and not about using written music. And so there was a gift in shifting fiddle teachers for me at that time that I didn't see, and I'd miss my friend Gary, but I'm grateful to right. have found Gretchen, and it's helped my music a lot. But with Gretchen, I started working on learning all by ear. So she and I carry no written music with me anymore. And that's why sometimes it's hard. I started a different tune because it's hard to keep all those tunes straight in your head. But the it's been a gift. And so these tunes are just passed down. So I would sit down with Jim and on his screen porch and a Bluff Park in the neighborhood they live in Birmingham. And he would he would play a tune for me. Then he'd give me a few notes and we'd work it through. Fiddlers are more about the feel of the music and the tune and the sound. It's not about the precision. And there are things that you can't do that a violin player can do. But what I'll also say is a lot of people who are classically trained in violin, if you set them down in a group of fiddlers and say, okay, you know, here's the tune, let's learn it. And they're like, where's my music standing? Where's my music? And they can't do it. So they're different skill sets.
And what about something technical like what they call second register, where you go down?
You can do that. Like a capo. Fiddlers use it some, but not as much. But
how is that taught? Is just you just figure it out?
You just figure it out by ear. So I was interested in tracing back this music somewhat, just embodying it where it came from, the Southeast music. And then living in New Mexico, I was interested in the music of my birth home, which is the Southeast, and my now home, the Southwest. And I started thinking about, and I haven't found any books that were written about this, but so some of this is just my own imagination through this project. But if the music of the Southeast came through Scotland and Ireland and across the Atlantic and then down the wagon trails into the Appalachia and took its own shape and form in the mountains of the Southeast, my guess is, and doing a little bit of historical imagination here, is that the music of the Southwest left Spain, also across the Atlantic, but went south and came through Mexico and then up the Camino Real on an opposite journey and path into the Southwest of the United States. And it also got caught in the hills, but here in the Southwestern hills in northern New Mexico and also over in Arizona. And the music that is traditional of this part of the world has a lot of fiddle music in it also. It's very different than the Southeastern music. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in learning some of the Southwestern music. Honestly, I don't have as many of those tunes committed to memory. And so I won't play a bunch of that for you today. But I found a couple like Jim and Joyce Cawthon in Alabama who had done a lot of research on Southeastern music. There's a famous group here in New Mexico called Bayou Seco. I don't know if you know them, but Jeannie McCleary and Ken Kepler live in Silver City. They lived in Albuquerque years ago, and they've actually played here at Las Placitas Presbyterian Church before my time here. And they have done a lot of research and oral history work with musicians, both the Spanish fiddling and the cowboy fiddling, which are both a part of New Mexican music lore. And so I reached out, cold called them. They're down in Silver City. And I said, can I come spend some time with you and learn some of the fiddle music from this part of the world? And they said, definitely. So I went down on the sabbatical and spent a week in Silver City. And they have a local community radio in Silver City that Ken's very involved in. Mm-hmm. And actually had my radio debut on the fiddle in Silver City, played with Ken and Jeannie some of the tunes that they taught me. And we played up at the Buckhorn Saloon up north of Silver.
The Buckhorn Saloon.
One night. So I had both my radio and my saloon debut on the fiddle that week. And I was the infant amongst giants. They're both incredible musicians and have been playing professionally for decades. Yeah.
And it's interesting you had mentioned the, as people traveled around the world.
Right.
Or when the people came from the big cities in the East and got on the wagon trains coming up to Santa Fe. Space was a commodity. You only had so much room in a covered wagon.
Right.
Yet they would bring a guitar or a violin. It must have been very, very important to include that.
Yeah. Well, one thing I learned from the work that Doug Orr and Fiona Ritchie did, and I mean, if you think about it, a lot of these people who were migrants, they didn't have a lot. And a lot of them didn't even bring instruments with them. But even if you don't have your instruments, you can carry a tune in your head, and it takes neither money nor luggage to do that. And so a lot of the music traveled with the people, whether they brought instruments with them or not. What Doug and Fiona revealed is that a lot of the boats that came across the Atlantic from Ireland over to America would have a fiddler employed aboard as forms of exercise to get the people up on the deck dancing, and to help keep the people happy over a really long and arduous journey. And these folks left everything, and left their family, and often to never return.
Right.
And so there's a tune called The Parting Glass that is a tune that I love. It's a haunting old tune. And it's a tune of goodbye from people who were leaving the Emerald Isle shore and into this unknown future in America, and often never saw their family again. And so this tune is it's a sad tune, and a tune of departure, but was a really important tune in the Irish tradition, and a number of American folk musicians. I actually really hooked onto the tune with a group that I saw at the Chemo Theater here in Albuquerque, the Waylon Jennies, who's a great Canadian folk group. And they use this tune to close a lot of their concerts. And it's The Parting Glass. It'll take you back across you'll hear the aisles in this one too.
It's so soulful, and it's one thing I'm noticing about the fiddle is that it's almost better that it isn't technically perfect.
Oh yeah, it's not about perfect. I'm not a skilled perfectionist in terms of that. I mean, obviously, if it's totally out of tune or you don't hit the notes, but if you listen to different fiddle players, and there's a lot of breadth and it's not as technically skilled.
But I would lose something if it was perfect.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Is there, I mean, as you get better and better, and we had spoken about The Devil Goes Down to Georgia, it's just a very difficult song. Is there one on your timeline that you want to become proficient enough to be able to play?
The next tune.
Okay.
I mean, it's the next tune I'm working on, whatever that is. You know, it depends on where I am. I don't have my long-term goal. So one thing I've learned in Placitas is that there are a lot of retired people here, And one of the best gifts I learned is people who are retired will say to me, have said to me, and it's part of what got me going on the fiddle when I did, was don't wait until you retire to do that thing you've always wanted to do. Because
exactly.
The chances of you picking up something you've never picked up in your life when you retire are less than if you've actually started it.
Right.
When my wife and I lived in Birmingham, Alabama, our first year there, our son Santiago was born, and we were living in an apartment on the south side of Birmingham on a hilly area in Birmingham. And there was a family that lived just below us in an old stone house. And the father in that family, who I believe was a professor at University of Alabama at Birmingham, one night a week used to sit out with a group of friends on the side porch of his house. And I don't know the man. I knew the family a little bit, but they would sit out and play music together. And there was a mandolin player and a banjo and a fiddle and a guitar player. And they'd sit around for a couple hours one night a week and just play tunes together. And I thought, God, I would love to be able to do that.
Right.
So my goal, my retirement plan is to play music with friends. Mm-hmm. And that's not, I don't have any aspirations of trying to do that on a stage anywhere.
Sure.
But if I could sit on the side porch underneath the portal somewhere and get together with friends.
With a glass of lemonade or sweet tea.
Or a cold beer and enjoy it. Probably more likely that. And just enjoy playing the music. And there's a camaraderie in that. And so that's really my inspiration and desire of trying to learn to play.
Found, Drew, that retirement is not really retirement.
Right.
I'm just unemployed.
Right. You're just not getting paid.
I'm far busier. I tell my wife, I need to go back to work because I have to relax.
Right.
Especially in Placidus, very, very active community
of
people equally unemployed like myself.
Volunteering at the local radio station or for the Placidus Artist Series or the such.
Right. Or I know I say a young lady, only because she's a couple years younger than me, retired art teacher.
Sure.
Goes into the elementary school
and teaches
art.
Right. That's part of the gift of this community. So, yeah, the music is something I've always loved music and have been more of a consumer of music than a producer. And it was beautiful at this juncture to be able to spend these months. The congregation took on the theme of the song lines of our lives. What's the story and the power of music in our lives? And that was inspired by a book that our sabbatical writing team read together called I'll come back to the title of that. But it was written, it's a book that Emily Saliers and Don Saliers wrote together. And it is the story, it's about the spirituality of music. And Don Saliers is a church musician who taught for many years at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And his daughter, Emily, is one of the two musicians in the group, the Indigo Girls, which is a really popular folk music group. Amy Ray and Emily Saliers still play as the Indigo Girls. And Don and Emily wrote this book together about the music as spiritual practice. And the first chapter in the book is called The Song Lines of Our Lives. And song lines is an Aboriginal Australian concept that the Aboriginal people in Australia understand that music was at the heart of creation. And there's actually song lines that would, in our day and age, be the GPS that helps us get across the land.
Right.
And people literally would sing tunes to help them travel a certain song line. And as you sang the tune, you'd walk the land and it would take you to your destination. And so what Emily and Don started riffing on was there are song lines in our lives that tell the story and power of music passed across generations. Don's father was a jazz musician who later came into church music. And then Don has spent his life in church music, but cut his chops early on in jazz. So jazz is an important part of his life. And his daughter, Emily, is a folk musician. And so they wrote this book together and we read it. And the team from the church here got really inspired by this idea of song lines. And so the fiddle is part of the song line of my life. And they decided to really focus. And a congregation has a song line. Music is, I came to realize, I'd never thought about it this way, but you know, a church is one of the few groups that gets together every week to sing.
Yes.
I mean, we get together as a congregation and we sing every Sunday. And it's a really important part of our life. Martin Luther said to sing is to pray twice. Ah. And there's this deep sense that music has such a... music is one of the most important parts of worship. And so they embarked on a journey of what is our corporate song line as a congregation and what are the song lines of our lives as musicians and as people. And I said, you know, whether you can sing or play pitch perfect or you can't carry a note in a bucket, you have a song line. Music is a part of all of our lives.
Oh, yeah.
And so we had people from the congregation who were sharing the song lines of their lives. That was one of the most important parts for the church while I was away. For the summer, we decided not to have a regular sermon each week, but we would have musicians who would play a good bit of music in the service, but then also in the service itself, tell the story of their song line. What did music meant to their life? Willie Sucre and I spoke when we were designing this whole sabbatical project for the church side of it. And I've known Willie through the years through the Plessy This Artist series. And so I told Willie, I said, we're going to do this project called The Songlines of Our Lives. And would you be willing to come one Sunday and play and share your story? And Willie just lit up. I mean, you know Willie. And he started glowing. And he said, Drew, he said, obviously in my world, I'm so often invited to come and play my music. Seldom have I ever been asked to talk about what it means to me.
That's important.
So Willie came one of the Sundays while I was away and was the main presenter and told the songline of his life. It's online on the church. So it's beautiful. If you haven't heard it, it was really incredible.
His story is inspiring.
And it touched Willie to be asked to tell it. And the same was true. We had other musicians. Charles Aguilar, who is one of the Matachinas fiddle players in Bernalillo, came and shared.
My first interview on KUPR
was with Charles.
And what a resource he is.
Incredible. So he came up and shared his music and his story during the summer. Then we had a number of other New Mexican musicians and people from the congregation. And then because of the grant, some of the funding from the grant was available to the congregation for their resource. And so I said, let's bring in some national musicians who can come and share their song lines and their stories. And one of the writing team said, I wonder if we could get Don Saliers to come, who had written this book with his daughter, Emily. I said, call him. I said, it doesn't hurt to ask.
No.
And so Don said, I would love to. So Don Saliers came out and kicked off the sabbatical. The weekend that I left and went to do the Ghost Ranch Bluegrass week up, I love bluegrass. And so I went up to do bluegrass fiddling up at Ghost Ranch in Abiquiú. And Don Saliers was here in Placitas and led the congregation on this kind of kickoff weekend of the songlines of our lives and helped them to explore what the role and power of music was in their lives. Then we had Bill Carter, who is a jazz pianist, incredible jazz musician, and also a Presbyterian pastor in Pennsylvania. And he came out and did a whole piece on jazz. And the church, part of the impact of that was the Sunday before Ash Wednesday, we had a jazz service here at Las Placitas Presbyterian Church with a bass player and a drummer and a piano player, incredible. And then they came back and did Easter service too. So we had jazz Easter at Las Placitas. Then we also had a Carrie Newcomer, who is a amazing musician, and she's a Quaker who's done a lot of work with Parker Palmer, and she came out. We had Ana Hernandez, who's an Episcopalian liturgical musician who does a lot with helping congregations and communities find their heart song through chant. Obviously, chant is a huge part of religious music. So we had different styles of music and different musicians bringing different genres in. And then Billy McLaughlin is amazing finger-tapping guitar player who is a friend of mine. We've known each other for decades. He's based out of the Minneapolis area.
Right.
And Billy came out at the very end of my sabbatical, and he and I were back together for my first weekend at Las Placitas and played a little bit together. It was mostly that weekend we had him playing because he's the musician of the two of us. I just play around.
Well, there's big A or big M musician, little
right,
M.
Right.
And as you've explained, we're all musicians in one way or another.
Music is huge. And so on the pastoral sabbatical, one thing I learned years ago about that
is... And is that a solo trip or does the family go?
We did both. I'll talk about that. We... when Billy was here, we did some play in together, and piece of the pastoral sabbatical is, what is it in your day-to-day life that you love, but your responsibilities as a pastor always put to the background? And take the sabbatical as an opportunity to bring it to the foreground. And so that's where the fiddle really stood out for me. And we did some traveling together as a whole family. We were, thanks to the generosity of this grant from the Lilly Endowment, we were able to spend a month together traveling in the UK and in Spain. I was at a fiddle week on the Isle of Skye with Alistair Fraser, Natalie Haas, and a bunch of local Scottish musicians. And then at a fiddle week in northern Spain in Burgos, or near Burgos, in a little town called Arlanzón, a beautiful agricultural town in the Castilla-León region, just between Galicia and Catalunya into the south of the Basque Country.
Right.
And part of my intent there was just embodying some of those tunes that would have made their way to New Mexico and some of that music. And so obviously folks who ended up in New Mexico came out of the Spanish roots.
Sure.
So it was just a gift.
And music festivals seem to go hand in hand with local food.
Oh yeah, great food
and
good red wine in Spain, and some nice beer and Scotch whiskey in Scotland. And
but in the Catalonian and Basque food is
beautiful, beautiful,
delicious.
So here's a tune that I learned from a Basque fiddler. Arkaitz Minor is his name, and the tune is called Amo Euskadi. It was written by a pastor of sheep in the Basque Country in the early 1900s. And the way Arkaitz explained it to us, he says, it's not an official anthem of the Basque Country, but it's as close to a folk anthem for the Basque Country. And it's one of those that the people in the Basque Country just gives them chills about their connection to the land. Ama in the Basque language means mother. And Euskadi is the name of the Basque Country, the land. The Basque people call their land Euskadi.
Right.
So Amo Euskadi is like mother country land. And so this was written by a pastor of sheep, of ovejas, in the Basque Country. And just a beautiful tune. And I'm thankful to Arkaitz for teaching it to me. Let's see if I can pull it out. Need to go back on sabbatical so I have more time to work on these tunes.
Speaking of that, teenage children, at least from my experience, or myself as a teenage child, not super embracing of parental interaction at that age. How did they take to, oh, dad's going to go play violin?
We had a great time. My sons and I, they were both born in Alabama. And so we went back to Alabama for a father-son trip. and spent some time with my family who's still there. And then they did some things while I was fiddling, and then we had time to do things together. I was here in New Mexico, so I'm going to Silver City playing with a great fiddler who you all brought to Placitas. Thank you. I got to spend some time with Jordan Wax up in Santa Fe, and you all just brought him to Las Placitas with Lon Piñon, and he's just an incredible fiddler. And then we all got, we'd never traveled together as a family. Like, we were able to Europe, and I mean, just a chance of a lifetime.
Yes,
to do that. And then my wife and I got a little bit of one-on-one time and got to go to North Carolina when I was in the Asheville area playing with some Appalachian fiddlers. And so it was just a treat. So we did a blend of things. I did some time. I had a week of my own at Lake Logan at this retreat center, and just sat and played my fiddle to the fish in the hills in North Carolina, and went back to the place that had inspired me to, it's really a muse for me to be in that place, and loved it.
So, and I'll use that as we close out here.
Yeah.
We spoke a little bit about learning the fiddle, no music, versus the way I started very traditionally.
Right.
And I'm finding from our conversation today that what I really got out of it was far more effective than going to a therapist or a psychologist. Mm. It's you and the instrument,
right,
and whatever you two can do together.
Right.
And that is so good for the soul and the brain.
It's healing.
Yes, very.
And you know what? I've had so many people since I started this who've said to me, oh, I've always wanted to play X, whatever that be. And I've started saying to people, I said, well, do you want me to tell you how to do it? And they're like, yeah, I do. How do you do that? And I said, well, what I can guarantee you is if you don't pick it up, you're not going to learn to play it.
Right.
So I can't guarantee that if you do pick it up that you will, but the chances are much greater if you pick it up and start working at it that you'll have some level of skill on it at some point. And when I started in my 40s to play the fiddle, I thought, I'm too old to do this. You know, how can I start learning at this age? And then I thought, you know what? The good Lord willing and time given, I could play this for 20 or 30 years. And anybody I know that has played an instrument with any dedication for 20 or 30 years is actually pretty good at it. And so I thought, you know what? Now's the time. And so I picked it up and started playing.
And you always hear the stories of, you know, the 65-year-old grandmother who went back to med school.
Right. So let me pull out a few tunes for you. I'd love to play a couple of more. There's a tune that Alistair Frazier, talking about this oral tradition of music, taught us that is called Sky Dance. There's a wicked history on the Isle of Skye related to Presbyterians and the fiddle. There was a Presbyterian pastor who is reported to have had all the fiddles he could get his hands on piled up and burned them all because fiddles were getting people in trouble from the dancing and the promiscuity that followed with the fiddle music. But there was also a Presbyterian minister on the Isle of Skye who put together a lot of tunes and saved them and collected them. And when they were redoing the Clan Castle there on that part of the Isle of Skye, they found this collection of tunes saved away in the top of a castle tower. And Alistair Frazier, for a long time, actually had a band called Sky Dance, and he was mesmerized by these tunes. And so the first tune that he taught in the oral tradition to that whole group that this past summer on Sky is one of the tunes from that collection that's titled Sky Dance. And he just, it was the first day we all met. That afternoon, he said, all right, pull your instruments out. And he started feeding us notes. And this is the Sky Dance tune. And to learn this tune on that peninsula where it had come from and was preserved and to be in that place was just remarkable.
Magical.
You'll hear Scotland in this one too.
Definitely Scotland.
So I have a Presbyterian minister to thank for saving that tune when I generations older than myself, and then Alistair Fraser for teaching us that tune. The tune that hit my heart the deepest of all the tunes I learned in the sabbatical is a tune called Domnall na Ndún. Mike Voss is a Scottish fiddler, incredible fiddler, and this was a tune that the clan leader there on that part of the Olive Sky, when he died in 1625, this tune was a funeral lament for the clan leader. This is a Gaelic tune. We were at a university called Sabal Morosteig, which is the Gaelic university in Scotland. And Domnall means leader of the world, and Nandún was this man's name. And so he was the clan leader, which would have been the leader of their world, of the sure. Scottish clan. And this tune is just haunting. And Mike, we were on that little piece of this earth where this tune came yeah. from, and this funeral lament from 1625. And it's been the heart tune. Matthew, I think there's parts in all of our lives that are always dying or need to die so that new things can be born. And this tune just spoke to me, and it's I love it. This is
and I'll say we need to wrap up. Good. So as they say, play us out with this.
I'll play and, out with this.
I'll thank you now for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. It's been a treat. Thanks for listening. And this is Domnall na Ndún.
So for KUPR, Matthew Bronson, Reverend Drew Henry, we thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
We'll see you on the radio.
Sounds great.